die, Father, is nothing less. Ever since I was a child, I had the feeling that something is missing in me. I want to know why I'm here. Can any of us know that?
Become yourself. Then God and the devil don't matter.
I want to learn. I want to understand. Be careful. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lives to live together in yourself? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb.
And you must learn what it means to become responsible.
This is an exact life. And that is why you are here.
To the unknown future. This is Release Radio. For the Seeker.
Another Red Eyes Radio program. Thank you for being here today. I'm Henrik Palmgren. We are based out of Sweden, and if you're new to the program, we urge you to take a look at redeyescreations.com for more. We do cover a lot of different subjects in our attempt to find answers to many other questions that we have about our forgotten history, covered up past, and also the mysteries of this world. Danny Vandermeene is a theoretical biologist specializing in the evolution of behavior and human origins. He's the author of Them and Us: How Neanderthal Predation Created Modern Humans. Danny's also a member of the Independent Scholars Association of Australia, and he joins us today to discuss his theory of human origins, beginning with a reassessment of Neanderthal behavioral ecology, and he'll explain what is known as a Neanderthal predation theory. All right, welcome to the program, Danny. Thank you for coming on, first of all. We do appreciate it. There's going to be a lot of fun. We have a lot to talk about and a lot of interesting aspects. So thank you for coming on, first of all.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I'm delighted.
Excellent. Now, your book is fascinating. We're going to get into it more today. It's a lot of components to it. We're going to go through some of this in more detail. First, I thought we could just kind of I wanted to ask you about your interest overall in this subject, Danny. I mean, you have a past as a filmmaker, but this question of human origins and, of course, the Neanderthals as the extension to this. When did you first get into this, and when did you decide to write a book about it?
It's interesting. Yes, I was a filmmaker originally, and there was a hiatus between films, and I decided to write a book about the relationship between myths and movies. As a filmmaker, I was interested in the idea that so many movies are based on myths that are basically common to all cultures, and they're hero myths and good and evil and dark forces and monsters and stuff. And I, in this book, it was called Tribal Movies, I thought I'd write one chapter on how it is that humans all around the world seem to be hardwired with the same stories. It was something that came about from Spielberg taking E.T. and these films around the world and finding that they resonated through all cultures, that there were deep kind of primordial kind of resonances. So that's fascinating. I just wanted to write a chapter on the biology of that, how it could be. And when I went to the scientific literature, there was nothing. There was nothing that suggested how it could be that humans all around the world have common myths about forest creatures, about yeti-type creatures, about underworld, about monsters and stuff. And so I decided to explore that scientifically. And I looked at Jung and a few other people and theories of the collective unconsciousness, but it didn't quite resonate for me in terms of hard science. So I grew into it and basically put aside that book and spent the next 5 years researching how animals and humans acquired new behaviors and new emotions. And eventually I had a paper published on the evolution of behavior, and that ended up as a started writing a book about it, and then the publisher thought, when I told the publisher this theory actually had threw up some insights about human behavior. He wanted a book on that, so I ended up writing a book on human behavior. But basically, that theory, which I call team theory, argues that if an animal or human is kind of experiences an extreme emotional reaction to something, that can cause a mutation, not in the protein coding DNA, but in the non-protein coding DNA, and it can get encoded into the genome as emotions or an emotional memory. So when I applied that to humans, I kept seeing evidence that humans have this preoccupation with these monsters. And eventually I was kind of saying, well, what monsters could have hunted humans? And the obvious thing was Neanderthals. And so when I looked at the period when humans and Neanderthals had interacted, it turned out it was a period about 100,000 years ago in the Middle East. And so the theory developed from that Neanderthals were not the benign, sweet cavemen cousins that we thought them to be, but something much, much more sinister.
Something completely different. That's right. We're going to get into that, of course. But basically what you're saying is that there must be something real to this kind of primal fear that exists from mythology up to our modern day movies. This is a recurring theme, in other words, and there must be something tangible, something real behind it. That's what you're trying to, you know, say here, basically.
Yeah, real, but not necessarily tangible. For example, a few days ago, I mean, I often get interviews from people interested in cryptozoology and the idea that there are these creatures around that like snowmen and yetis and yowies and abominable snowmen and things and forest creatures. Pretty well every culture in the world has these forest-dwelling creatures. They're often hairy. They often come out at night. But significantly, despite thousands and thousands of sightings, alleged sightings and so-called experiences over the years, there has not been one solid actual proof, not one actual being produced. And, you know, obviously lots of reasons are put forward for this, but what I believe is that these creatures did exist once, and they're hardwired into our genes, so we have a sense of them. We have a very primordial sense of, like any prey species has, that these creatures did exist, but the fact that they no longer exist is simply, I think, because Neanderthals no longer exist. They're extinct about 26,000 years ago. So, but they still exist in our consciousness, and they still control our lives to an extraordinary degree.
Very interesting. Now, there seems to be a fascination with the Neanderthals around the world as well. Scientists are looking close at their DNA. There's even, I mean, speculations to try to, you know, reproduce them. You know, this has been a concurrent, you know, an ongoing quest, I guess, ever since the ideas of, you know, Jurassic Park kind of manifested themselves into the, you know, the collective consciousness, as it were. But what do you think the fascination is then with the Neanderthals, Danny? Why is it so hardwired into us? Let's get into it.
Well, I think it can work on several levels. One is just simply the philosophical idea that we don't want to be alone, that we kind of seek some other being. You know, we have a fascination with aliens and with other things. It works at that level. But also, I think with Neanderthals, you know, that they have come up through the science and through the fossil record as tangible beings that did exist, and they are a species of hominid. And of course, we kind of want to know who our cousins were, because they're the closest relative we have. I mean, you have dozens of thousands of species of different types of birds and kangaroos, and dozens of, but you know, there's only one of us, and you know, I guess we want to sense that we have our cousins, and I think this is part of this anthropomorphic thing, that we want to see our cousins as like us.
Indeed, definitely. Now, let's talk about the basics of, you know, the Neanderthal predation theory and what that entails. We have obviously two main sections, if you will, to this. We have, as you call it, the them, which is us, and then or the Neanderthals, and then we have the us, which is us, of course, and these, how these come together in history. We need to go back in time, obviously, to know when this interaction started and so forth. But just give us the basic first of Neanderthal or predation theory, Danny.
Okay, I'd be delighted to. But just even before that, just that term, them and us, I remember once Googling it, and it came up to like 5 or 6 million hits. And there it is. It's in our consciousness, this idea of them and us. But there is no, in theory, there is no them. It's a kind of, again, it's like these mythical crypto creatures that are thought to exist. It's just part of our genetic makeup, this concept that there are them out there. But okay, so basically the theory is that you have two species in particular. I mean, there were quite a number. There could have been 20 or 30 hominid species around the place in Africa. But one of our direct descendants moved up on the east bank of the Nile River, up through the Middle East and into the area called the Mediterranean Levant, which is comprised of Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Palestine. So that area on the banks of the Mediterranean, basically, and they inhabited the coastal region, and they lived there. The first evidence is about 1 million years ago that they moved up, and so periodically the climate change in Africa would pump people and animals out of Africa. If it got too hot, they moved into the Middle East, and so there was a long-standing archaic population of early humans living there. Now, at the same time, or about 500,000 years ago, another group of African hominids moved into Europe, and they became Neanderthals. The problem is, though, that Europe turned into an ice age, and Neanderthals were trapped there. And so, rather than this pleasant, benevolent climate that our ancestors had in Europe and in the Middle East, Europe was a glacial wasteland. And this, I propose, had a very profound effect on Neanderthal ecology and evolution, because it basically, in Africa, you had about 120 edible plants, where in Ice Age Europe, you only had 5 or 6.
Yeah.
And those that did grow there were of such low nutritional yield, they weren't able to support a hominid. So basically what I'm arguing is that this created selection pressure for Neanderthals to give up their omnivore kind of eat anything diet and become predators to get enough meat to sustain them in the cold climate. And so over the 500,000 years, I argue that Neanderthals became top flight predators, what we call an apex predator. And we know that they were hunting the biggest and the most dangerous animals on the planet at the time, woolly rhinos, mammoths, cave bears, Eurasian lions. These are ferocious creatures, and Neanderthals are known to have hunted them all. And so they gradually became much bigger, thicker, stronger, 6 times stronger than humans. And I argue that they had very long, dense, thick fur coats to protect them from the cold. They had the cold also affected their faces. I argue they had flat faces, very thin lips to avoid frostbite, and they basically looked much more like a primate, because both humans and Neanderthals are of the order of primates, so they're descended from primates, and I argue that Neanderthals basically were great big hairy brutish apex predator that hunted pretty well everything.
Yeah.
Now what happened is about 100,000 years ago, a group of these European Neanderthals moved into the Middle East, and they became what we call the Eurasian Neanderthals, a kind of subspecies or sibling species. And what I believe happened is that the Neanderthals basically started hunting those early humans, but just as another food source. No big deal. They just saw them as a kind of meek, passive omnivore, and they started hunting them occasionally. But the interesting thing, I also believe that they started hunting them for sex as well, because the two species were sexually compatible, and so they could produce fertile hybrids. And so I argue that the Neanderthal men, males, would periodically attack human camps and abduct females. And this caused an extraordinary kind of stressful threat for the humans. And this is the start, I argue, of our evolution. This is this interaction, this predation by Neanderthals, is the kind of start that changed humans from an archaic, dumb, middle paleolithic hominid into what we are today.
That's right. The main crux of this, of course, is basically why did the middle paleolithic human, you know, suddenly evolve and develop into the upper paleolithic human? And this is, you know, believed to have been taking place in the Levant, just as you said. And there is a very interesting theory here, obviously, which counteracts everything else. And why don't we just set the stage a little bit of how we were, you know, before this change took place? What did we eat? How we were, you know, behavior and everything else? We've been pretty much very much the same for a few millions of years, if I believe this correctly, Danny.
Absolutely. And that's interesting. You see, people kind of somehow naturally assume that humans progress naturally towards this sapient, sentient creature that we are today, extraordinary intelligent. But realistically, from an evolutionary perspective, there is no need for that kind of intellect under normal circumstances. In fact, for humans kind of have a trajectory from very basic primates over about 5-6 million years, and for much of that we were middle paleolithic, which means that we're simply quite dumb. You know, we made tools and we've made fire, but that was about it. But we survived. Our ancestors survived both in Africa and in the Mediterranean Levant with those basic skills. There was no need. And you know, because evolution is costly. You can't just develop this. You don't develop this great intellect and brain and all these other skills that we have for nothing. There has to be some what we call evolutionary selection pressure, some pressure to achieve these adaptations. Otherwise, there's no point in them. So, you know, our ancestors survived perfectly well. And I'm arguing in my book that when these Neanderthals came, and what I'm saying is that Neanderthals were, we know they were cannibals. There's at least 9 sites in Europe, and there's evidence going back 100 years where they were cutting up the bones of other Neanderthals. So we know they were cannibals. We know from their teeth, and it's called isotope analysis of dental enamel, that what their diet was, and it was 99% meat. This idea that they were like us, we ate, our ancestors ate 32% meat, and that was at the high end. Most of our diet was kind of plant-based. Whereas Neanderthals were, these are for me indications that they were a top-flight predator and that they were used to hunting. And one of the interesting things about nearly every single predator is that they hunt nocturnally. They hunt at night because prey are easier to capture when they're asleep or resting. So I'm arguing that these raids happen at night, and this is kind of source of our kind of deep primordial fear of the dark, and of monsters in the dark, of the boogeyman, and all these kind of fears that we have. This is because if you think what it would be like to be hunted, but this went on for 50,000 years. This is what I'm arguing, between 100,000 years and 50,000 years ago, and at the end of which, the human population in the Levant, which was estimated to be minimum of 3,000, I believe was reduced to as low as 50. And there's genetic evidence.
50, for 5, that. 5, 0, hardly 50, anything. 50, we're hanging by a thread.
one geneticist said we're within a cigarette paper thickness of becoming extinct.
Yeah.
And we know that from the genetic variation of human DNA. In fact, one geneticist did a study of a group of chimpanzees in the Thai National Park in Africa and found more genetic variation in that group of 50 chimpanzees than there were in the whole 7 billion human beings. So basically, this is evidence that we went through what's called a population bottleneck, that the population at one stage shrank to almost nothing, and then spread out again. And this is, for me, this population bottleneck is the absolute crux of Neanderthal predation theory, because when the population is small, whatever's causing it to be small has a profound effect. In other words, the Neanderthals, if they did hunt and interbreed with humans, and as I theorize that the Neanderthals males were abducting and raping and having sex with human females and producing hybrids, but at the same time reducing the population, decimating the population until there was almost none left. Basically, this is when evolution kicks in, because the only humans to survive were those born with particular skills and traits and attributes that help them not only defend themselves from the Neanderthals, but also to turn the tables on them. In other words, the only ones that were left were those that were extremely smart, extremely aggressive, able to kill Neanderthals without compunction, able to make smart enough to make tools and weapons and arrows and bows and things like that, creativity to fashion and invent new weapons. This is a suite of traits that are all characteristic of modern humans, and they were only selected and useful because they had a function in terms of this great reversal, this predator-prey reversal, where the predator became the prey. And this is this great kind of turning point. And this is where humans went from being middle Paleolithic to upper Paleolithic. And we can actually tell almost exactly from the tool evidence, the fossil records, when this happened. It happened about 47,000 years ago. So the predation started 100,000 years ago. For 50,000 years, humans were decimated, and they adapted all sorts of things to prevent sexual predation. So that's when they started to have private sex. They could no longer have sex in public because Neanderthals would pick up on them. They started to be very aware of their body sense because Neanderthals could smell them from miles away. So they started to mask their body sense with flowers, and anyone that they started to prefer humans that had less fur on them, that looked less like Neanderthals. The hybrids were killed off. So there's all these kind of dramatic implications that you would expect if one type of hominid was predating another species, particularly with sexual stuff. So the sexual predation was one of the kind of most important aspects of this whole thing, because the ones that were eaten, humans that were killed and eaten, obviously didn't leave anything for selection to work on, so they were out of the gene pool.
Yeah.
But the ones that were interbred, that they were able to, they were survivors, so they were able to react to these evolutionary pressures and acquire adaptations to lessen the degree of sexual predation. And these kind of things, for example, the Neanderthal, I argue in the book that the Neanderthal sexual system was the same as the current primate sexual system, and that's basically based around the female cycle, ovulation cycle. So when primates, females are ovulating, their genital area swells up and their genital area turns a kind of purple and then a dark purple. And this acts as a visual cue for the males, and then this kicks in their hormones and they attempt to mate with their females. So, and I'm arguing that originally human females had this exact same system, that this was a time before romantic love,
mm-hmm.
before breasts, before a lot of these systems, so that back then mating was simply worked on the basis that a female went into an ovulation cycle and you could see it. You could see the cycle, you could see when they were ovulating, and the male would mate. Now, I'm putting forward the theory that because of Neanderthal sexual predation, these symbols, these outward signs of ovulation became maladaptive. They drew Neanderthals. Neanderthals could smell humans, females. They could see the signs, and this would attract these raids, these lethal raids by Neanderthal males. So this, I argue, caused this huge change in human sexuality, the physicality of our sexuality, and in fact, the whole way it works as a system. Before predation, humans had no breasts. Females had no breasts, just like, except when they were lactating, except when they were feeding babies.
Mm-hmm.
So by developing breasts full-time, that even when they weren't lactating, was a put-off sign for Neanderthals. So Similarly, humans are the only primate species to have hidden ovulation, where there's no obvious sign anymore that, the female is ovulating. It happens internally. And so we don't have this great anogenital swelling. We don't have these kind of secretions of hormones. We don't have a coloration of the vaginal area. So these things are all gone. And instead, this has for me created this kind of really interesting dilemma, an evolutionary dilemma, and that is that if hidden ovulation was designed to put Neanderthals off, to keep them from raiding, would it not put humans off as well, human males? And it possibly could. And so this is where I argue that romantic love came on the scene as an adaptation, so that human males who would love and prize these females because they were Neanderthal proof would tend to have more recreational sex in the first 6 months or year, and therefore by having constant recreational sex you would end up maintaining fertility rates,
right?
Which was obviously from an evolutionary point something that you'd want. So all these things, it's a very radical theory and it has very wide implications, and I can see that it is so radical that it takes a while to kind of accommodate. But, you know, it's based on simple Darwinian logic of how evolution works, and how when you get selection pressure for something, when something's killing off something, adaptations are selected that somehow moderate or alleviate that whatever's killing. So, for example, you know, if bears are in the Antarctic or in the Arctic and the cold's killing them, then after 10 years, the only bears that are around are the ones with long fur coats. It's simply
right.
Selection.
Yeah, that's right. The big mystery here that we're trying to get to is comprised of two elements, basically. It's why is our behavior different? Why are we different than any other animal on the face of the earth, as far as we know? And also, extension to that is, why do we look different? These are the two questions that you've been trying to answer. Something was instigated so that we headed off in a different, completely different directions. And there are a couple of theories that exist surrounding this, and yours is one of them, of course. But I think one that you bring up that we could just kind of check off here a little bit is by Richard Klein, argue basically that we had a major genetic mutation that occurred basically because of climate changes, even maybe to the point of being catastrophic in its nature. Why, in your theory, does this not fit? Why is climate not a non-issue here?
But I'm just trying to think, how would climate change affect breasts and hidden ovulation, our propensity to be genocidal, our propensity to be fear of strangers, our love of music, our dance?
Yeah.
Well, how would climate change create or justify or make our propensity to dance adaptive? You know, a lot of these theories may explain one thing. I'm not even sure what it explains. I think unfortunately, Klein is, with all respect, is off the track.
There's another one. I wanted to get your take on that as well before you move along, of course, and talk about your theory. But the basic idea that it's through entheogenic or hallucinogenic drugs, basically, that mankind has developed a completely different inner world, if you will, even to the point of language and stuff like that. You had people like Terence McKenna and some of these other people have argued that it's actually a dietary supplement, if you will, that we accidentally started to ingest, and this has developed into rituals and everything else and art and stuff like that. What do you think about that theory?
Yeah, I there's no question that humans have had an extraordinary relationship with plants over their history, evolutionary history, and in particular with plants and substances and compounds that alter their perspective. So, you know, that's definitely there. It goes through many, many cultures, but not all cultures, obviously, but because some didn't develop these technologies and compounds into a kind of hallucinogenic form. But yes, it was there, but I see it much more as a kind of cultural habit thing with no serious evolutionary consequences. Again, if you say, how does taking a hallucinogenic drug affect this great plethora of human characteristics that we call human nature. Why does it make us kind of want to conceal our bodies? You know, we're the only. Why does it? Why do we have to hide our sex? Wear clothes? Why do women prefer men taller than themselves? Why do men prefer women with symmetrical faces and a hip to waist ratio of 0.7:1? These are all things that are hardwired into us that these peripheral theories don't appear to explain.
And we're going to get into that later, of course, of what these different cultural properties, if you will, things that we've developed in our behavior, how this, you know, fits into the theory. But one line from the book is basically, nowhere in nature do we see natural selection resulting in so much unbridled creativity as in predator and anti-predator adaptations. So this is the situation that we're talking about here. Neanderthal as yeah. the predator and mankind as we know it today as being the predated one, basically. Maybe we can describe a little bit more of the conditions that would exist here. We have an intersection for about 50,000 years, speculatively or so, that this primarily took place in the Levant. And what were some of the conditions, do you think? This is very difficult to describe, but what would it be like for a human being alive at that time being faced with this immense threat, do you think?
Yeah, well, this is interesting because this is where science kind of slows down and you have to speculate. And for someone who's trying to do a scientific theory, this gets me onto slightly risky ground. But I think it's a very valid exercise because it's important to the evolutionary scenario. So there's a few things we do know. We do know that the humans lived in the coastal plains. And we know that the Neanderthals were a forest-dwelling creature in Europe. And it appears that they were up in the mountains. But then at one stage, and you can actually see this very clearly in the fossil record, the human caves that were occupied, for example, in Mount Carmel in Israel, that were occupied by archaic humans, were suddenly taken over by Neanderthals. And so they lived there in those coastal caves. So there was this kind of interaction where I believe it didn't even have to be every day or every week or every month. It could have been, but I think it was certainly to do with the female. The interaction was driven by females. That you see, other primates like chimpanzees, there's a thing called lethal raiding and coalitionary killing. These are things where male chimps from one group will go to another camp at night and raid it and basically kill members of the other camp and abduct females. And it's a harsh kind of system, but it works from an evolutionary perspective because it brings new genes into the troop. Otherwise, you would have kind of too much interbreeding and that would become maladaptive. So these kind of harsh techniques of chimpanzees raiding each other's camps and taking females, and also females voluntarily leaving once they become adolescent and going to another camp to find fresh males. So these interactions were there being played out back then as well, because if I'm correct, then these two hominids were basically living out their primate history. They were using primate systems. So occasionally a human female would perhaps volunteer herself into the Neanderthal camp. Occasionally Neanderthals would raid a human camp and carry off children to eat or fertile females to have sex with, and there would be hybrids. And so what I'm arguing is that the most dangerous time in the life of any human at that time was the minute they were born, because the minute they were born, the other males would look at them, and if they perceived Neanderthal traits, if it looked like a hybrid, they would be euthanized, they would be killed.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was this terrible kind of demarcation, not just between the two species, but within the human population, because there were hybrids everywhere. And this created this extraordinary kind of animosity. It basically made females select humans who had bigger lips, who had a nose that stuck out, who had less hair, who had a didn't have that characteristic Neanderthal gait, who were slender, who were thinner, who were smarter, who could dance, who enjoyed music, because these were all perceived as non-Neanderthal traits. The Neanderthals were considered this brutish, demonic predator that came out of the darkness, and with their great big eyes. Their eyes were significantly bigger, and like other primates, they had brown instead of eye whites that we have now. Early humans and Neanderthals would have both had these brown eye whites, and so humans would have increasingly preferred other humans with clear eye whites. So all these things, the noses, all this slowly, but the main one that I believe that the evolutionary pressure of day-to-day existence was the issue of body hair. Now, it's interesting because people say, the current theory is, oh, humans lost their body hair in Africa because it was hot and they were allowed to sweat. And in my mind, complete nonsense, because all the other animals that live in Africa, from lions and leopards and cheetahs and zebras and giraffes, and they all have body hair. And it turns out, when they researched it, that body hair creates a kind of microclimate that actually insulates the body from the hot sun and also works at night. Now, for humans to lose their body hair is actually a kind of a complete evolutionary kind of disaster, because nights are cold, body hair keeps animals warm, it keeps them from getting skin cancers, it keeps them from getting sunburned. But my argument is that the pressure, this idea of hairiness from a distance, being able to identify a Neanderthal by the long hair, and it may well have been a dark-coloured hair, because in Europe, it was so cold that darker hair tends to be selected by animals in cold climates because it absorbs heat, like the brown bear and the black bear and other things, except in the polar bear, because that's white and it's advantageous to camouflage. But most other bears are a dark color.
Yep.
So these things had this, over the 50,000 years, changed slowly, simply because of mate choice. Women prefer men, and men wouldn't, if a woman mated with a Neanderthal, then they would be killed too. But the crucial thing is that there was a lot of evidence to show that our early ancestors weren't great hunters. They were kind of timid, kind of docile creatures, and that had to change. That was the main thing. We had to become much, much, much more aggressive to be able to encounter a Neanderthal. Given that Neanderthals were the absolute top predator of the time, they had spears, they were smart. One anthropologist in America described them as wolves with knives, which is a kind of apt description, because it's this kind of paradox of this weird thing to comprehend: a creature that looks like a gorilla but can make fires and can bury its young even, and that is cunning and works as a social predator and group predator. So, you know, there are these extraordinary contradictions of us encountering these nocturnal things. So over the years, these kind of things were part of our DNA. They became, like other predators are able to identify, other prey are able to identify predators before they see them, or predators are able to identify prey and know that that's the animal they've got to hunt without ever having seen one before. So they become innate. And this is an absolutely crucial kind of system, because it shows how humans, under this subliminal influence, made all these choices. So even though you're not aware of it, you look at a human and say, I don't like him, and you don't even know why, but he could be too hairy, or his eyes could be too big, or his lips could be too thin, but these subliminal things are influencing our choices right up to today.
Yeah.
So even today, this idea that someone says, oh, they're Neanderthal-like, infers and suggests that whole suite of traits that we associate with Neanderthals, with these predators.
Now, Danny, were we an easy target at the time? Because it seems also, if we were diminished only to be around 50 at some point in southern Africa, I believe. I mean, it feels like they were out to get us pretty much, but there's, what, 193 species of monkeys and apes, and do they go after all of them, or do they select us to kind of go after, do you think?
No, I think I personally think that when the Eurasian Neanderthals moved into the Middle East, it was, I use the phrase in the book, nothing personal. We were just meat.
Yeah.
It's all just meat. So they were hunting. They, you know, it's like a lion has no animosity towards the antelope that he kills. It's simply available prey. And Neanderthals would have hunted us. They may have preferred other prey. They appear to prefer in the Middle East, they seem to like antelope and some deer and some herbivores. But, you know, there's no question that they hunted the biggest animals. And they, what we do know, strangely, is that they actually preferred mature animals. So they wouldn't actually hunt small rhino. They would hunt a mature rhino. And it's thought maybe because they ate so much meat and there were that they needed the big prey. But it's difficult to know exactly the details, but
their build was significantly different from ours. They're much stronger. They needed how much meat approximately? Like 1.8 kilograms of meat or something like that per day?
Yeah, I estimated they had to eat the equivalent of 25 Big Macs a day just to maintain body temperature.
Right.
So these are. I mean, if you look at I know it's kind of weird, but if you look at a gorilla, they're about the same size as humans, and they weigh 3-4 times more. And so that's the kind of body build. And when you look at the skeletons of Neanderthals, their limb bones are almost twice as thick as us to take the strain of the great muscles. So the chest barrels out, this great big chest compared to ours. So they had these kind of very quite unique features. Their eyes were in a different position in their heads to us. Their eyes were about where our foreheads are. And they had very large brow ridges, which I believe worked as kind of sunshades in Europe when for the ice. So it kind of protected their eyes. But their eyes were also significantly larger than ours too. I did some research and they turned out to about 20% larger. And I argue that this was a common characteristic for nocturnal predators. They tend to have larger eyes. But I also theorize, and this is slightly speculative, that there's a problem with the normal circular pupil. In as much as the muscles don't allow it to close down really, really small. So in the snow, in places like that, you could still have problems with eye damage from the snow. But there is a pupil called the slit pupil, which closes up like a curtain, and that is able to close much, much tighter. And there are some animals that have these that in cold climates, and I speculate that it's possible that Neanderthals had this type of pupil, which would have given them a very scary appearance, like monsters. And, mm-hmm. and you have this preoccupation with monster eyes throughout human mythology. It's just prevalent.
Yeah. And so you're arguing also that, you know, the evidence for this is in the fact that we have an obsession with it, and it comes through our art and what we're drawn to, if you will, when we're, you know, want to go to the movies or whatnot.
Yes, because the theory is, it goes back to team theory, is that if you've got these emotions in you and you're feeling them, you kind of create a story to encapsulate those feelings. So it's like when you have a nightmare and you have this feeling, you create some fantasy to support the narrative. And artists work in a kind of trial and error system. So they write something or they produce something or they direct the scene and they tell whether it's right or not, right or wrong, simply by the feelings it generates. And so if you have this feeling of a nocturnal hunter, you know, you can create an alien that will do it, or a gorilla that will do it, or a dragon, or anything, because they all, as long as they evoke the same feeling of nocturnal dread and threat, and particularly also to do with the female abduction of creatures that will come and carry off women. And Greek mythology and Roman mythology and Indian and Asian mythology is full of these narratives that tell of some creature coming from the dark, from goblins or from the underworld, to abduct, and then some hero, i.e. us humans, who will go out and vanquish them by virtue of their intelligence, aggression, courage, creativity and weapons. So all the things that we admire are the qualities required to vanquish Neanderthals.
Interesting. Now, a gorilla that we talked about before, it, you know, leaves, bark and roots, flowers, fruits and grubs and stuff like that. How do we know that the Neanderthals ate primarily meat?
Oh, that's kind of relatively easy because of this. When teeth grow, there's an isotope that is a marker of what was in the diet, and so you can actually, this isotope analysis now confirms very clearly that what the Neanderthals ate, and it's 99.8% meat. So they were just like cats or tigers or something. That's what they ate, and they had systems to digest it, and because basically only meat could provide that high protein yield that's required to sustain a creature of that size in those kind of climates.
And although they worked themselves through, I believe that this is how it worked down basically, because when we were decimated to around 50 that we talked about before, we were in South Africa at that point. And so this means that the Neanderthals also worked themselves down through much of Africa. Is that correct?
No, definitely not South Africa.
Okay.
No.
Okay. I'm thinking about the mitochondrial Eve that they speculated that was down there. So yeah. That's what I'm thinking about. That's another story. But yeah. Go ahead. Yeah, explain that.
Yeah. No, what happened? It was interesting. I published the book. The book came out in September 2009. And in May 2010, less than a year later, the draft sequence of the Neanderthal genome was published in Nature magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a kind of multi-million-dollar a huge international study to sequence the Neanderthal genome. Now, a few things came out of that. One was that they showed quite clearly that there was gene exchange between Neanderthal males and human females, not the other way around, but from Neanderthal males to human females. They also worked out when it happened. They estimated it happened between 80,000 years and 60,000 years. And they also determined when it happened, and it happened after the migration from Africa, but before the migration across through the world. So by that, they could pinpoint it very clearly to the Middle East. So in that one paper, it basically confirmed three principal tenets of the theory, and was quite fortuitous for me, because often people have theories and that predict certain phenomena or observations, and they have to wait 20, 30 years or 50 years or after they're dead for these things to be confirmed or denied. And I was very fortunate that a year later, this study confirmed all the premises of the work.
Oh.
Not all the other details, but the essential basic hypothesis of the work.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, in the book, you talk quite extensively about the, I think I pronounce this correct, maybe, who knows, Skoulkafse hominids.
Yeah.
Is that how you pronounce that?
Yeah. I mean, they're Arab terms.
And these are basically the ones that we believe are the closest to, you know, how the hominids were at the point in time when this predation is in, you know, in its high peak, basically, right?
Yeah. What you see there in that fossil record of the Middle East is you see these archaic humans that, from their skeletons alone, look relatively modern. They were kind of basically pretty much the way we are. But then you get this period where some of them appear to have Neanderthal features. And for a long time, paleontologists were furiously debating whether some of these specimens were Neanderthals or humans. And they couldn't work out, and some of them, you know, because we're talking about small fragments of jaws or bits of mandible or something. So these were not a lot of great evidence to go on, but there was lots of speculation. But for me, the thing was quite clear that these were what they were looking at were hybrids. These were specimens of early humans that had been interbred by Neanderthals and so had features of both. And then after that, once the Neanderthals are gone, then it goes back to a much more gracile current form that we have today. So what happened, just to continue that story, is that these new superhumans, basically they were Cro-Magnons, they were about 47,000 years ago. What I'm saying is basically that these, all up and down the Middle East, there were scattered survivors. So maybe in Jordan there are one or dozen or something that managed to hang on, and in Israel there were another dozen or something. Eventually all these survivors coalesced into a kind of single population or a single tribe, a super tribe of super survivors. And by interbreeding, they consolidated their characteristics. So one was courage for males. But a lot of these characteristics only applied to males. So it was males that ended up fighting the Neanderthals, taking the fight to the Neanderthals. So they had to be courageous. They had to be extremely cruel and able to kill without compunction. And today, you know, this is a very sad thing in human culture that we have genocide. And genocide is unheard of in any other species, even in other chimpanzees.
Sure.
You don't get a propensity to wipe out whole species. But humans have this, and it's trying to understand it. And it makes sense in terms of once we perceive them as Neanderthal, once we Nazis perceive Jews as, in the subliminal sense, as them, once these demarcations are made, then we slip into this homicidal Cro-Magnon kind of sense where it allows us to kill without compunction, where we're not seeing them any longer as human. We're seeing them as animals or termites or ants or some kind of horrible scum that just deserves to be killed without mercy. And when that happens, and, you know, humans can kick into that under the certain circumstances, when certain triggers in the book that I talk about, that where that can happen. And when it does happen, we're back in the Middle East killing Neanderthals, because that's what happened. Basically, the humans started to, these new superhumans, fully cognizant, sentient, smart, cunning, ruthless, started to hunt Neanderthals and kill them mercilessly. Now, what the first thing they did is they eradicated the Eurasian Neanderthals, and that happened relatively quickly. The Neanderthals just suddenly disappear from the fossil record about 45,000 years ago, just gone.
Yeah.
Then because those humans basically went on a blitzkrieg hunting Neanderthals. This was their raison d'être. This was their purpose in life. They were basically a anti-Neanderthal killer species. We are, by virtue of kind of our evolutionary past, a purpose-built, the new apex predator whose sole purpose and function was to kill Neanderthals. And we spread out from east to west across Europe, and gradually, slowly, not over a prolonged period, wiped out all the Neanderthals in that east-west direction. So as humans moved across, you know, there's been lots of theories to try to explain why Neanderthals disappeared at the same time as humans.
Yeah.
And some of the theories are kind of quite silly, to be quite honest. But the one that I put forward, and that I put quite a lot of evidence to support, is that basically there was a violent replacement, that as humans went across, they hunted every Neanderthal down, and finally there was some of the last populations of Neanderthals moved down the Iberian Peninsula to the bottom of Spain, and when they hit the Gibraltar and the Mediterranean, they couldn't go any further, and then about 26,000 years ago, they were gone too.
Huh.
Then at the same time, these super aggressive humans spread out across Asia, towards Asia and through India and Russia, and wiped out Neanderthals there. So Neanderthals disappeared there at the same time. But then this is a new phase that happens, that you have these groups of super aggressive. These are not humans that you would recognize today. These were kind of almost demonic maniacs, psychopaths, I call them, because they had no sense of guilt or anything. They were just absolute
ruthless.
They were creatures of their time.
But they had to become like this in order to survive. That's also one of the points you're arguing.
Yes. Yeah. But, you know, we're talking about hunting an extraordinarily ferocious creature.
Sure.
So this is the only reason they could do it is because they had weapons.
Yeah.
There was no way that humans could defeat Neanderthals in close combat. We had to use weapons, and the weapons of choice were thin javelins and the bow and arrow. And when I looked at the archaeological evidence for arrowheads, for projectile technology, it was exactly where I expected to find it about 47,000 years ago. And the first ones are found in the Levant, in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
So it's further proof that this introduction of projectile technology was associated with the demise of the Neanderthals. So, but what I argue then that happened, I mean, and again, I'm just extrapolating Darwinian theory of what happens in normal evolutionary scenarios, and that is that you have these marauding groups of males, predominantly young males, hunting in a kind of nomadic, traveling fashion, hunting up and down the coast, into the mountains, in a kind of blindly looking. But after about 26,000 years ago, there were no Neanderthals left. They just existed in our memory, and people would talk about their great-grandfather killing one of these beasts, or their uncle, allegedly, or there was one sighted, so that they kind of drifted from actual beings into a kind of mythology, and people would talk about them, or these Cro-Magnons would talk about killing Neanderthals around the fire, and how brave the humans were, and how these dastardly creatures would come up from their underground caves to attack beautiful women, and how the men would save them. So these become part of human mythology, and they spread out. But the other thing that happened is that these groups, when they met each other, would look at each other and ascertain how human or how Neanderthal-like they were. So if one group came across another when they were moving back to Africa, they would see other hominid species, and basically, if they looked too different, they would eradicate them with their technological weapons and their superiority. They would kill them all out. But occasionally, if they found some that looked human, slightly humanish, they would interbreed with them. But in other places where you have two groups of Cro-Magnons who would look at each other and make determinations about how human or Neanderthal they were, it would often end up in fights. And so you have this period of what I thought would be extreme violence. And this goes right into the Neolithic. Now, this is going to about 8,000 years ago still.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at the fossil evidence of the Neolithic, you find it is a period of relentless and unmitigated violence, that almost every excavation shows massacre sites. There are just all over Europe, and there are just sites of carnage and mayhem, of crushed skulls and traumatic wounds to skeletons. So there's this period, I argue, of extreme violence where these super aggressive macho men were basically killing each other off. But fortunately, that had a kind of good effect. It basically started to get rid of some of the most aggressive genes from the gene pool. And, you know, we're still a very aggressive species, but a lot of those super aggressive genes got wiped out. And also the other thing that I think happened is that because these young men were so ferocious and so violent, and that women started to not select them as mates. They started to prefer males that were going to be involved in child rearing and supporting and protection. And so that also had an influence. So you had these new kind of evolutionary forces that started to moderate the worst excesses of the Cro-Magnons, and so you end up with something that we've got today. But, you know, this idea of these violent men, things like religion, civilization, the rule of law, these things started to, were artificial cultural constraints that also started to mitigate and to moderate
Well, Danny, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that in the second segment. We're going to take a break here in a minute or so and talk more about this, because it, of course, as you're explaining this, it has, you know, huge implications, obviously, where we're at today, but also kind of the you know, the background, if you will, of mankind. And there's some other aspects to, like, you know, how art and dance and some of these cultural traits helped us to survive, basically, what that had to do with it. But before we take a break, Danny, why don't we talk a little bit more about your websites and where people can go to, of course, pick up a copy of the book if they want to read more, and anything else you have going on. I think you have sold the rights for this for a TV show as well. Is that correct?
Yes, I have, but as far as I know, it hasn't happened yet, so I don't know what's happening there, you know, what films are like.
Okay, yeah. But it might be coming out on the screen in one version or another.
I hope so.
Yeah.
There's a website called themandus.org that listeners can go to. There's also my other site called thesecondevolution.com, which is kind of like the master theory, if you like, that from which predation theory was derived. So there's those two sites, but unfortunately the book's not published in Europe. So, but it's available on. You can, probably the best thing is ebooks. You can get ebooks from the Them and Us website.
Absolutely. So again, here the website that we're talking about is themandus.org, and then we also have the secondevolution.com for more on that as well.
Yep.
The title of the book is Them and Us, and we're going to continue talking more about this in the second segment. So stay with us, everybody. Stay with us, Danny. We'll be right back after this. second hour, we'll speak more on the disappearance of the Neanderthal from the historical record. Daniel continues on selection pressure for strategic adaptations, including cognitive ability, male aggression, language capacity, gender roles, and creativity. We end the hour on the sad consequences of predation, deeply ingrained into our consciousness. He explains how awareness is fundamental to understanding our past and where we are to go in the future. To continue, listen, sign up for a membership at redicemembers.com. And with a membership, you'll get full access to our archives. Lots of good stuff for you right there, so do try it out. We'll return in just a few days with Scott Volter, but again, then right now, we'll proceed with Danny Vendramini, Hour 2. Talk to you on the other side.